This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another installment of Hometown Heroes, the program where each time we take a trip back in time, listening to stories from our greatest generation, we aim to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice, to preserve their stories for posterity, so hopefully ignorance can't be an excuse, that we do not forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And of course, there's always that hope that in looking back to the past, we learn things, whether by education or inspiration, that will have an effect on our future. I know you consumed plenty of turkey this week. Hope you had a great Thanksgiving. I sure did. And if you consumed any media over the last week, if you read a newspaper, watched television, listened to the radio, or really spent any time online, I'm sure you could not miss the enormous amount of coverage devoted to the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. So many reflections of the man he was and the legacy he left behind. Over the years on Hometown Heroes, we've heard from a few people who knew President Kennedy, but I was reminded in particular of a man who had helped rescue him during World War II and even spent a few months alone in a tent in the jungle living with JFK. I thought if ever there were a reason to revisit a program from the past, this might be it. Because without this man and the orders he carried out 70 years ago, it's likely we never would have had a President John F. Kennedy. His name is Ted Robinson. He's a great storyteller, and he's still going strong in Sacramento. At the time of this interview, he was 91 years old and had just gotten off the tennis court.
I played for Duke University. I played for Flushing High School, which the U.S. Open has made in Flushing, which in the 20s was the number one high school team in the United States. I was number two on that team. I was only number seven on Duke, because Duke has some great tennis teams. In fact, their girls won the NCAA championship this year.
And who did you play today?
I played a gal who once played Althea Gibson, the great African-American tennis player in Los Angeles in 1962 for the Women's World Champion. She lives here in Sacramento. She was number one on the German Federation Cup team at one time.
And she's only 67.
Yeah, she's getting old.
How long are you going to keep playing tennis?
Well, as long as I can. I gave up skiing, black diamond, high-speed skiing, just 3 years ago, and that's only because my big buddy ski partner, who's 11 years younger than I, had to give it up. So I lost my ski partner, and otherwise, I'd still be doing that. I'm very lucky in my health and very lucky in World War II, as you will hear.
Well, and you wouldn't be talking to me if you weren't. And if not for something you were involved in, we never would have had a President John F. Kennedy. We're going to get that entire story from you. You talk about being from Flushing, New York, and being a tennis player in Flushing Meadows. And I'm just flashing back to a story I did on television long ago here in Fresno at the sewage treatment facility. They have a big green area that they call Flushing Meadows. And every once in a while,
right? They'll
go out and hit some tennis rackets around. You get the joke, of course, Flushing Meadows at the sewage treatment plant. But a little different than what you grew up with.
Yeah, well, you know, Flushing actually was the ash dump for New York City back when everybody used coal in the winter for heat. Flushing Meadows, they dumped all the New York City ashes there and actually filled up a huge hole that. And so the stadium where the U.S. Open is played is on top of all that, those ash remains in New York City that was dumped there. So Flushing is kind of a dump.
But it gave us you.
Nobody from Flushing's living, but that's really a very nice place. It's all Korean now anyway, so they wouldn't understand. They all speak Korean in Flushing now, and they're very nice people.
You grew up in Flushing, New York, and how did you become a Navy man?
The reason that the title of the book is The Pauper. My dad died very suddenly, right at the end of World War II in that flu epidemic. He died in January of 1920, and I was born. I was 8 months old when he died, and we had a Packard car, a chauffeur, a limousine. He was vice president of W.R. Grayson Company at age 32. He was the Wall Street Journal had a big article that he was just a financial genius. But he hadn't expected to die at 32. And suddenly, gone was the Packard car, the governess. and he the will paid off the mortgage on the house and left her some stocks, which of course became worthless during the Depression in 1929-30. Mm-hmm. And my mother, we lived. I was brought up by my grandfather, my mother's father, who was stone deaf, lame, poor janitor, just in total poverty. We had a nice house, but my mother had to go door to door selling greeting cards. And at 10 years old, I was trying to sell pork sausage meat door to door in a Jewish neighborhood.
Good luck with that.
That's true. Yeah. So, what do you want to know next?
Well, and you in your write-up on your book, you describe yourself as being the poorest kid at Duke. Did you go there specifically to play tennis?
No, there were no tennis scholarships then. There were no scholarships of any type. But I came number two in Flushing High academically. And I could have gone to Harvard or any of those great schools. But Duke was cheap. In those days, the Duke Cathedral had just been finished a year before I went to Duke in 1936. And it was only $795 a year. It is now $46,500. But when I went there for two reasons. One, it was far cheaper than the other really fine schools, and Duke was a fine school. But stop and think about it. Duke was the number one co-educational school on the East Coast. Harvard, Princeton, Yale, male only. Smith, Wellesley, girls only. I like girls. I thought it was very abnormal to go to a school with just men or just girls. And so that's why we chose Duke. It was cheap. And they had some very beautiful Southern gals.
Uh-huh. Now I understand your thinking.
Yeah.
And you had already graduated from Duke by the time Pearl Harbor rolled around. Do you remember where you were on December 7th, 1941?
Yes, I was. I had a very fine job with the Chemical Bank in New York, which is now part of Chase Manhattan. I was an executive trainee. Because the chemical, every bank in America has a corresponding bank in New York City because Wall Street and all is the financial capital of the world. And Chemical was the head of the southeast part of the country. Duke was in Durham, North Carolina, so they wanted Duke graduates because they served all that area, Florida, Georgia, Alabama. And I was both gone to Duke, and I lived in New York, so they had brought me in as a executive trainee, and I had a wonderful job. But I had already gone down in May of 1941, before Pearl Harbor, and signed up for the U.S. Navy because I could see we were going to get into this war. And also, if you read my book, there's a wonderful story in there about some neighbors of ours, the Scott family, who owned lock, stock, and barrel what was then the first Walmart in the world. It was the Army-Navy stores. And old Captain Scott was a graduate of Annapolis, and during World War One, he was the chief of staff for supply of the United States Navy. So do you have any idea how he might have got a hold of the Navy stuff for that? But anyway, they eventually saw our tragic condition, what had happened when my dad died. My dad had been friend to Captain Scott's. My dad had a bigger job than Captain Scott. So we stayed in the house because it was paid off, and my mother kept secret how terrible we were doing until a time in the book that you have to read that they discovered we were just about starving. And so they began to feed me, my brother and I, because my mother, well, I get too emotional about how bad off we were. And they kind of adopted my brother and I, and there was no doubt that I would go in the U.S. Navy because it was a Navy family that literally saved our family. Wonderful, wonderful people.
Well, that is good enough motivation in my book. And so yeah. You had already enlisted in the Navy. But where were you? What do you remember? How did you find out that the Japanese had attacked
Pearl
Harbor?
Well, I was out playing touch football. in a lot, and some neighbors hollered over that we better cut our game off and go down and get in our uniforms because the Japanese had just attacked us at Pearl Harbor. We were out playing touch football, and so I ran home, and I called the Navy right away and said, do you want me? And they said, no, you're due to go in the class of, and it starts January 22nd at midshipman school, and you just come at that time. So I quit my job with a chemical bank, and I went skiing in Lake Placid. Even though we were poor, I knew it was my last chance to ski. And I went up skiing, and I've been a great skier ever since. I love skiing. In fact, I moved to California because here you can ski at 12,000 feet at Heavenly Valley, although that's a pretty tame resort, I think. Next question.
Pretty tame for a 91-year-old, huh?
Yes. Yeah. I'm a pretty good skier. Black Diamond.
You told us your memory of December 7th, 1941, that your touch football game was interrupted by this radio announcement that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor.
Right.
You said they let you off the hook till the next month, January, when you entered midshipman school. Did you know that early on that that you would end up in PT boats, or how did that develop?
Well, at the end of I was a 90-day wonder. I had to be. I was in that V7 program where if you were a college graduate with top grades and all the things that Annapolis teaches, like advanced math and all, in 90 days they try to make us a hero and an officer and a gentleman. My wife said they didn't do a very good job in the second part. But but anyway, I came out number two in my midshipman's class, and our company, which was the number one company, Company 5, in midshipman school, and so I was allowed to choose my own duty. They took most of the 90-day wonders and stuck them on a 3-inch gun in some merchant ship going across the Atlantic, but if you were the tops, you could choose your own duty, and so I chose PT boats because it really irritated the hell out of me that a little junky country at that time, like Japan, would have the nerve to attack us. And I wanted to go right away out there and get them. I mean now. And so I chose PTs, even though they told us it was suicide work. And I said, yeah, it's going to be suicide work. Who's on the other side? Not me.
Well, you talk about that. And the most famous movie, I think, about PT boats, or one of them anyway, with John Wayne, is called We Were Expendable, or They Were Expendable. I mean, that's not a very good label you want on the kind of ship that you're leading.
Well, John Wayne, incidentally, is a friend of mine. We had a cottage for 36 years after the war at Balboa Island, and I could see John Wayne's house from our cottage, and I've been on his yacht. I spent a whole half a day with him one time. And believe it or not, when I asked him for his autograph, he said, no, I want yours. And that's one of the most flattering things that ever happened to me.
Maybe after trying to portray a PT boat skipper, he knew what you had been through.
Yeah, and I arranged to get him a plaque for his yacht. His yacht is actually a Navy minesweeper that's been converted into a huge yacht. And we had a PT boat reunion in Newport Beach, California, one time. And we also had it on his yacht. So that was, I know him. Next question.
Well, so you made that choice to go on PT boats, which was certainly not the safest choice. It was a daring choice. You're not going to have a lot of protection. You're going to be in the thick of some serious fights.
You got to be a little nuts, actually. Actually, they sent us immediately after Pearl Harbor. Immediately after we were formed up at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, they sent us down to Panama, assuming the Japanese would try to destroy the locks after they destroyed our Pacific Fleet.
Right.
And we spent the first couple of months down there waiting for the Jap fleet to arrive, and we had one squadron of PT boats and one squadron of P-40 airplanes, and they said, you guys stop them. And we waited for them, but they never showed up, so we had to go over to Guadalcanal and get them.
Well, absolutely, and there aren't many veterans of the Pacific War who can relate action this early on? I mean, this is 1943 that we're talking about, that you were over there right in the thick of it.
Yes, it was a year and a half before Omaha Beach.
Exactly. So,
we were out there with the 1st Marine Division, of which I have the greatest esteem. You might be aware that the big ship Navy left the 1st Marines on Guadalcanal and had to abandon them for 3 months because the Japanese Navy was so strong, and they had 22 airfields within 100 miles. And so the big ship Navy on our side couldn't get up there, and when they did, they almost always got sunk by those wonderful long-range torpedoes the Japanese had. The Japanese outnumbered them, and we had terrible losses of the major fleet up there. But those 1st Marine guys hung in there, and they knew we were the only things out there for months trying to stop them at sea.
This is back in 1943, but here 70 years later, we need to hit the pause button and take a break. We're listening to Ted Robinson share some of his World War II story. His book, Water in My Veins, The Pauper Who Helped Save a President, is linked on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. That president, of course, the one we've been reflecting on so much nationally over the last week, John F. Kennedy. We'll get to that element of the story when Hometown Heroes continues right after this.